An event more than 30 years ago that still has repercussions today was the televised hearings of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. After it was all but completed, a bombshell accusation about his behavior toward a young associate caused the reopening of hearings, as Anita Hill testified about his harassment of her when they had worked together. Ultimately, it did not derail Justice Thomas's appointment, but it did open discussions in this country about workplace behavior that still resonate and change the life of the woman at the center of that conversation. I'm Rick Jackson. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. Now, professor and lecturer Anita Hill comes to Cleveland this week, her only conversation prior to that visit talking exclusively with The Sound of Ideas. The first half of today's program focuses on the work she's done since 1991 in and out of the classroom. Later this hour, we look at the work of scientists and researchers interested in the potential medical benefits of psychedelics, psilocybin, LSD, ecstasy. Researchers have now begun a therapeutic study here in Ohio. First, the latest and national news. It is The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for joining us. Good Monday to you. In October of 1991, millions of Americans were glued to their TV sets, watching attorney Anita Hill's explosive testimony, accusing then-Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas, her supervisor at the United States Department of Education and the Equal Opportunity Commission, of sexual harassment. The allegations came from her time as his legal advisor. That testimony, more than three decades ago, helped shape Hill's mission to fight for better workplace environments and to bridge the gap of gender inequalities. Hill has told CBS News that since her testimony, the ongoing fight against gender-based violence, quote, has been evolving, although she thought that by now, quote, it would be over. That fight for equality and justice has led to the writing of three books. Hill's most recent, Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence, was released in 2021. Anita Hill will be at the Maltz Performing Arts Center this Wednesday, speaking at the invitation of Case Western Reserve University. We begin our hour today with a conversation with Anita Hill. Professor, welcome to The Sound of Ideas.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, and welcome to Cleveland when we get here later this week. So 30 years later, clearly we are short of our hoped-for goals, but where do we stand on progress in the fight for equality?
Well, we've begun, really, I think, what is one of the most important things to start with, and that is bringing the issues to the public. And that's been done in a number of ways. We have, of course, the Me Too movement, where there were millions of tweets about people's experiences with harassment in the workplace and many other experiences of harassment and abuse. We have people who have stepped up and talked about their problems, especially in the entertainment industry. We have now seen two or three, but I will just say the Weinstein trials reach high-profile level in the media and with the public. So we have this public conversation about the issue of sexual harassment that we've never had before. And I think the more people that we can get involved in that public conversation, the way that we can move that conversation beyond the headline cases to the everyday workers' experiences, the better the conversation, the richer the conversation, the more diverse the conversation will be.
I'm glad you brought up the Me Too movement. I know none of us could have imagined in 1991 the need for that, but in what way should we have been maybe more understanding and enlightened America? Have we become? Not that it should be celebrated, but are you pleased to see people standing up that way?
I'm absolutely pleased. I mean, because before there were so many repercussions for even voicing a complaint. You know, people were afraid to speak up. And that fear has been lifted somewhat. Not to for everyone. There are still people who are vulnerable who say they cannot come forward. But you know, that is as I say, it's an important part of the conversation. Getting people to talk about their lived experiences. And that started to happen, especially in 1991, when people were just sitting around their kitchen tables talking to their families about experiences they have had, which better informs all of us. It begins to inform the next generation. And we have seen that generation, the Gen X and the millennials as well, step into this conversation and into this issue and demand change.
You have made fighting for gender equity, putting an end to sexual harassment, your life's goal. Does it ever get easier to talk about 1991, or do you ever think to yourself, it's time to pivot, think somewhere else?
Well, you know, I talk about 1991, but I also talk about 2018 and 2017. I talk about, you know, the Me Too movement 5 years ago. I talk about Christine Blasey Ford's testimony, you know, and I tie all of this to current events, including Justice Jackson's confirmation hearing, and the way that our public bodies respond to women who come in, perhaps have different ideas than they have, but have different experiences that we want to bring to the fore. And so, you know, I am not tired of talking about it because the issues are still out there. They're salient. And we still have lessons to learn from them. You know, 22 states in the wake of Me Too, 22 states and the District of Columbia have passed more than 70 workplace anti-harassment bills. And some of those have been passed with bipartisan support. And we can talk about those and say, yeah, we claim victory. But what we really need to do to keep this conversation going, to keep it meaningful, is we need to make sure that the laws are being enforced correctly and that people are, in fact, getting what they need to be able to do their work in the workplace, to achieve to the best of their abilities without the fear of harassment either stopping them, preventing them from working, or even causing them to leave and move on to another job.
In an interview, I read that you said, when I testified, people didn't even know there was such a thing as sexual harassment, and then the people who knew about it didn't know it was against the law. We've come a long way from that point, but the pushback against it really still hasn't ended.
You're absolutely right. It has not ended. And my fear, honestly, with this Supreme Court, we don't have major sexual harassment cases coming up now on the horizon for the court, but they will be coming up through the lower courts and the courts of appeals. My concern is that there will be an effort to shrink protections as opposed to expand. The more people speak up, we think that there will be an expansion of the laws that protect people. However, we're not seeing that. I mean, the court actually, in the last 10 or 15 years, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg pointed this out to us, have been looking at the protections in a very limited way and being more inclined to really let employers off the hook for eliminating the problems that exist out there, creating more, I won't say loopholes, but more opportunities for employers to do what is basically compliance, training compliance approach, as opposed to an approach that actually eliminates the issue and eliminates the problem in their workforce.
Professor, let's expand beyond employment and the courts. I heard you speaking about the Larry Nassar case with the Olympic gymnast. You talked about how it's not just behavioral, that dealing with one person does not mean the problem is going to be over. In the Nassar case, after these girls complained, he went on to molest and abuse 70 to 100 more victims. Do our systems of response actually enable future Larry Nassars, future Harvey Weinsteins?
You know, one of the reasons that we had not heard more and have not done more in this area is that we have for a long time convinced ourselves that the problems that we face are just behavioral, that if we get rid of one or two bad apples, then the issue is going to disappear. Well, Larry Nassar gives us a prime example of the idea of systemic and institutionalized behavior. There were so many ways that Larry Nassar was protected to do this behavior, and the institution was not being held accountable, and they certainly weren't holding him accountable. There were people in the criminal justice system when young women, students, many of them went to the police. And because Larry Nassar was a high-profile person with a, respected physician, they weren't believed. Deference was shown to him as opposed to believing these victims. The same was true with the FBI. This is what we call institutional complicity with behavior. Whether it's law enforcement or universities themselves, where presidents and other administrators just excuse the behavior or just ignore it, whether it is the American public that just sort of defers to the word of powerful men. We have a problem when those deferences get built into our system and our culture. Then that's what we have to address, those institutionalized responses that dismiss our claims and put more people at risk. And that's what happened with Larry Nassar.
You mentioned institutions. We had an email come in talking about the idea of the role religion can play, especially in our patriarchal society. Wanted to know, do you have thoughts on how to wrestle with people's personal beliefs, how they might be at odds with what many think should be a more inclusive workplace culture?
Well, the first thing that we have to do is to bring people together to actually listen and understand what is going on. And I think that, once again, what we're talking about are some long-held cultural beliefs that from the beginning were really anti-woman, misogynist beliefs that really, in fact, were protecting patriarchy. And, we've got to start to challenge really where those beliefs were coming from, who they were benefiting, why in this day and age we should be rethinking how we can really observe our religion and at the same time make sure that we are keeping people safe from harm.
Thank you. Had another email come in asking about your opinion of President Joe Biden. He chaired the hearings back then, and this person was saying she didn't vote for him just because of that. He did reach out to you as he was running. What's your relationship with Joe Biden now?
Well, I don't really have a relationship with him. I did speak to him once right before he announced that he was going to be running for the presidency. I'm at this point, my relationship with Joe Biden is about what he can do to make workplaces safer, what his administration can do. We are at a point now where he has the power that no one else really in this country has. And we still have government agencies where these problems exist. We still have private workforces where they exist. We have schools and universities where they exist. We've come a long way, and the Department of Education has started to put in new policies and procedures that I think will help us eliminate this issue when it comes to children, whether they're in elementary and secondary schools, or our young adults who are in university. That, I think, is happening today, but I would like to see more. I would like to see more attention to some of what I think are the misinterpretations of the law that the Supreme Court has made in the last few years, and I would like to see policy changes. I'm not naive. I know that in this political atmosphere, change is really, bipartisan change is really difficult. But 22 states have done something. The District of Columbia, 70 workplace anti-harassment bills have been passed at the state level. I think we can all do more, and that's what I would love to see from the Biden administration. Mm-hmm.
I know you've got to go shortly. I want to squeeze in one phone call here from Morgan in Akron, who has a pretty interesting question. Morgan, welcome to the Sound of Ideas. You're on with Professor Hill.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm trying to understand the situation from the standpoint that it seems that oftentimes employers and the broader society are automatically put to blame when younger people are let go or are not integrated as they would like to in society. But I want to know why no one seems to be addressing the decisions that young people make that affect their own lives. Now, here's an example. I'll go into a coffee shop and I'll step up to the counter and there'll be two young people working behind that counter. They'll both be, at least one or maybe both, will be on their phone staring down. They'll barely greet you. They'll have weird body tattoos or piercings, or they'll have eyelashes that generate a breeze every time they blink. And in general, they just don't have an acceptable work ethic. Now, if I were the owner of a shop like that, I probably wouldn't hire them. I would look for a 50 or 60-year-old person who looks like they're pleasant to the customer. They have a reasonably good work ethic. Maybe they're slower, but they'll get the job done. They're reliable, and I can trust them.
Thank you, Morgan. Professor, to his point, you know, is it incumbent upon the employee as well as the employer to be fair, to do things that make sense?
Well, I think, you know, the employers and the leaders in all of our organizations set the tone for their environment. They do. They are in charge of their environment. They set the tone. And I have been in plenty of places where young employees are quite courteous and they are quite responsive and they're quite congenial. I think what your caller is experiencing, and I'm not questioning whether he's experiencing
sure.
something that's not what my experience is, but I will say that it is incumbent upon the employer to set the tone for their workplace setting. But whatever an employee does, that does not mean that they can be harassed and abused.
Right. Yeah, that's the bottom line, that no one, no matter what they look like, deserves sexual harassment.
No one deserves it.
Looking forward to your talk on Wednesday. Lawyer, author, activist Anita Hill, thank you so much for your time here today.
Thank you.
Anita will be speaking at 6 p.m. Wednesday, the 22nd, at the Maltz Performing Arts Center. We'll have a link to the event details on today's show page. Just go to ideastream.org and click on The Sound of Ideas. Grateful to her for the time. On the other side of a short break, we'll discuss a new study at the Cleveland Clinic testing the therapeutic viability of psychedelics. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. It's The Sound of Ideas from Ideastream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for joining us. When you think of psychedelic drugs, what comes to mind? The hippie counterculture of the 60s, perhaps? A college dorm room affixed with black light posters? Maybe a Grateful Dead concert? How about a carefully curated and meticulously laid out room in a medical facility like the Cleveland Clinic? For decades, scientists and researchers have been interested in the potential medical benefits of psychedelics. That includes lysergic diethylamide acid, also called LSD, psilocybin, the psychoactive compound in some mushrooms, synthetic drugs like MDMA. Sometimes called ecstasy. The perception and acceptance of these substances has been shifting in recent years, with advocates pushing the federal government toward either decriminalization or legalization. Researchers and institutions like Johns Hopkins have had a more measured approach. They've begun using small clinical trials using psychedelics in therapeutic studies. And now, for the first time, a study will be underway here in Ohio. With me to discuss what's happening with psychedelic research locally, Dr. Brian Barnett, psychiatrist and co-director of the Treatment-Resistant Depression Clinic at the Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Barnett, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Also here with me in studio, Dr. Deepak Sarma joins me, the first ever inaugural distinguished scholar in the public humanities at Case Western Reserve University, also a professor of religious studies and bioethics there. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Excellent. He says he's ready to roll with it, folks, so the conversation should be good. If you want to ask questions, 866-578-0903 as we talk about psychedelics and research. You can also email us, SOI at ideastream.org. You can tweet us at Sound of Ideas. And before we get into this specific study, Deepak, let's set the table for how psychedelics have gotten to this point. Maybe look at the terms that come up in conversation. When we talk psychedelic drugs, what do we mean?
Right. So this is interesting, is that the creation of the term psychedelic has been a very controversial one. And now the kind of appropriation of psychedelics by the medical community is equally complicated and controversial. Mm-hmm. So clearly, when we're speaking with people on the street, often if you use the word psychedelics, it scares them. And it's something that it involves all kinds of stigma, as you already suggested, Grateful Dead and so on. And these are all things that have been given stigmas and really a lot of false risks associated with these drugs. I know that Dr. Barnett has written a little bit about risk assessment and LSD in particular. So I think people on the street tend to think that these drugs are dangerous. But as my research here in Northeast Ohio on a project funded by Case Western Reserve University, where we are looking at psychedelic use in Northeast Ohio in non-allopathic settings, I can assure you there are a great many people here in Northeast Ohio who do not think psychedelics are at all a threat, are all dangerous, and are already doing many of the things that that Dr. Barnett and others and are doing at the clinic and at Hopkins and elsewhere.
In and out on danger, but also in and out on legality. It's an interesting journey, LSD being legal in the U.S. for a while. Dr. Barnett, when and why did we see the government begin to decriminalize, or rather criminalize, substances like LSD?
Well, it was really in the late 1960s. So when LSD was discovered and started to be used in research, the larger society and the media were actually very positive about it. And so there was a lot of coverage in magazines and newspapers that was really extolling the potential therapeutic benefits of LSD. However, there was a change in the mid-60s when LSD and other psychedelics got caught up in the counterculture, and so was taken up by the hippies. There was a lot of political strife at that time, particularly around the Vietnam War, and so we really see psychedelics being made illegal as a casualty of what was going on politically at the time, and that ultimately led to the war on drugs, which has been very problematic, as you know.
I think it's important to add to that that there's a history of racism, and that once the scheduled drugs Schedule I drug list was created, it was really targeting African Americans, Latinx people, and so on. And I think that it's very important that listeners acknowledge that one significant portion of the creation of these scheduled drugs and making them illegal is to put people of color in jail, and that happened. So I think we absolutely have to acknowledge that. And that is also part of the kind of countercultural, when you have black power and you have people of color getting a voice, one way to deny them that voice is to put them into jail.
A lot of people have always talked about that in terms of the crack cocaine, but you're saying it was that way with psilocybin, LSD, et cetera.
You bet. I mean, and especially something like LSD, it was so sad is that people were going to jail for the weight of the acid. And if it was on paper, then the paperweight was included, and people would go to jail for 20 years for having just a few hits. Mm-hmm. So we have to include the kind of ideas of trying to put people in jail who are threatening the state, who are threatening the very idea of the state.
Politics getting in the way of research here.
You bet, and it still happens.
Mm-hmm. You're a professor, as we mentioned, of religious studies as well. How do you fold the study of psychedelics into a religious experience or a religious belief?
Right. That is just a fabulous question. So much of the history of psychedelic use over the millennia have been in what we would now call kind of religious contexts. Of course, the term religion is a relatively new one, created by Western scholars who talk about practices that we observe in the past. And many of those practices that we observe in the past, we will now call religious. People are engaging in all kinds of behaviors, and their rituals were communal. The people did them together. They were guides who helped make those rituals what they were supposed to be. And the intention sometimes was to have what we would call a mystical experience, the natural drugs, so to speak, things like ayahuasca or peyote or mushrooms, were worshipped as gods and goddesses. And so the ritual itself was what we would call a religious one today. And I can assure you that many, many people, not only in Northeast Ohio, but across the world, still consume these substances in order to have what we would call religious or mystical experiences.
Since you brought that up, I got an email already while you were talking about Peru and cactus and peyote. Is it dangerous? You know, we know that there are legality questions in different countries of the world, but that email was specifically saying, is that dangerous?
Is consuming ayahuasca dangerous?
Is consuming peyote?
I think that anything can be dangerous. I think it's all about set and setting. is that if you're in the right set and setting, and if you have a guide who knows what they're doing, and you are really clear about your intention, then it can be a very, very safe experience. I think that so many people who are probably listening here, who might be my age, I'm 53, remember people doing psychedelic drugs at Grateful Dead shows and people running around in kind of an ecstatic state. And there was a lot of uncertainty in those contexts. And in my observations now, the use of these psychedelics is so tremendously different than how it was used in the 80s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And now you see people here in Northeast Ohio who conduct rituals where it's everyone is brought up to speed, so to speak, and really
pun
made
intended.
Pun intended, okay. And made sure that they understand what they're getting into, that there might be an hour of chanting to make the right set and setting. Mm-hmm. There are people that I know who have taken lots and lots of these psychedelics but have never taken them outside because it's always been in a therapeutic, safe, controlled setting. And those drugs are not dangerous in those settings. It's really about how you do them.
Controlled being the key word there. If you'd like to talk to Dr. Sarma or Dr. Barnett, email us, soi@ideastream.org, or give us a call, 216-578-0903 or 866-578-0903. Dr. Barnett, getting back to this idea of religious belief or mystical experience, brings up an interesting conundrum for you and other medical experts. How do you put these experiences into words?
Well, I think by their very nature, they are often ineffable. But that is, something that we are, very focused on in these clinical trials is we are increasingly recognizing the importance of the mystical experience as the driver of the therapeutic potential. And so most studies of psychedelics that are looking at that therapeutic potential are sort of geared towards amplifying the possibility of a mystical experience through modification of setting, through preparing patients for the possibility of this experience and for integrating the insights that they gain from it afterwards. And so these trials are much more than just looking at the pharmacologic effects. We realize that for most psychoactive drugs, the effects are significantly driven by what we call extra pharmacological effects. So that would be set and setting. And psychedelics are unique in this aspect because they are the most sensitive to set and setting.
Is it difficult for the treatment-resistant depression clinic to argue that this experience is therapy?
I don't think so. I think psychiatry has really grown a lot in the last couple decades about what it perceives to be beneficial for patients. I think in the past, spirituality was neglected. However, there's a newer generation of psychiatrists who are embracing the possibilities of integrating spirituality within psychiatry. And so we're really seeing a significant shift in the field away from a very pharmacologically driven approach that was really came about in the late 80s and the early 90s.
Deepak.
Right. I'm really glad to hear that. What worries me is that many of these studies in many of these worlds, in Hopkins, for example, don't have people who are scholars who are involved in the humanities, who are scholars of religion, who are scholars of mystical experience, part of those studies. So, it's funny. In the kind of STEM-dominated world, students who are STEM-dominated don't take classes in religious studies, don't take classes on mystical experience, and now suddenly they become the people who are governing this without having had any background in this or creating the background as they go along. I understand, Professor Barnett, that you've, of course, done biology and anthropology, and that's wonderful, and you've had some kind of exposure to religion as it is understood through anthropology, which is very different from understanding it in the discipline of religious studies. So I'm very, very happy that the kind of issues of spirituality are being considered by contemporary psychiatrists in these studies. But I think that more needs to be done in including scholars in the humanities and the social sciences in these studies. And I really do wonder if religious communities themselves should have people participating, rabbis and so on, and priests of whatever variety. And then the question becomes about who is credentialed to actually do this, and will the religious tradition support this, and will the religious tradition, will leaders in the religious tradition consider that drug-induced mystical experiences, DIMES, drug-induced mystical experiences, to be mystical experiences? And these are great questions, and scholars of religion have addressed them. And it is a very sad, sorry state of affairs when they are not part of these wonderful studies, and that I guess that the wheel is being reinvented in some way.
Always, always. Yeah. I got to tell you both, we've got phone calls and emails lining up. You said you're ready to roll with it. First off, and I'll ask you first, but I'll go to you first, Deepak. Mm-hmm. Rick wants to know, have the guests experienced psychotropic use? And if so, which drugs?
Yes, I have, for sure, Rick. Perhaps you've known me. No, I think I can't say when. I think that would be inappropriate. Mm-hmm. But I have done lysergic acid, diethylamide, psilocybin, MDMA, DMT, CY19-DET, ketamine.
My goodness. Yeah. That's the list. Yeah.
That's the list. There are a few others in there, I'm sure. But of course, these things were all available when I was in college, and I want to emphasize that. Reed College, 1991, definitely was
different
possible.
Time.
Definitely
mm-hmm.
a different time.
Brian?
So for physicians, there's a lot of scrutiny around medical licensing and substance use history, and so unfortunately that's not something I'm going to be able to talk about.
Okay. I kind of thought there might be legality issues there. Jeffrey writes in to say it seems the drive to legalize all classes of drugs because of their perceived benefits without rigorous testing is folly. The plural of anecdotes, he says, is not data.
Right. So along these lines about FDA approval, I think something that we really do need to address is that the interest of the pharmaceutical industry, and maybe really that's what we're seeing, is that the pharmaceutical industry is seeing this as a great way to suddenly make new money. And of course, when we think about SSRIs, is that the bar was very low, both with the FDA and for the pharmaceutical companies, about what could be approved. And so those were pushed through very quickly, and pharmaceutical companies have made hundreds of billions of dollars, mm-hmm. not unlike the opioid scenario. And are we going to see the same thing with psychedelics? I imagine that we already are. And I want to emphasize then that the non-allopathic therapeutic use of psychedelics is continuing and will continue whether these drugs are approved and appropriated by the allopathic world and made part of the capitalist economy by the pharmaceutical industry.
Dr. Brian Barnett, got two emails for you here. Nate says he's used psychedelics in the past, found them extremely useful, suffers from depression, would love to try this therapy. Couple that with Doug, who says he conducted his own informal study back in the 70s. Any chance of getting in on this one? Serious question, though. How would people participate?
They are able to contact us. And so I'll just say that the study that we're doing right now is looking at LSD for generalized anxiety disorder. And so we're not doing anything for depression at this time, although we do anticipate a depression trial using psilocybin later this year. Mm-hmm. But anyone who's interested in potentially being screened for the study can give us a call at 216-828-5471.
828-5471. Got it. We'll put that up on our website, folks, in case you don't have a pen in hand. Let's go out to Mansfield, where Clayton is on the line. Clayton, welcome to the Sound of Ideas.
Hey, good morning. I had a question for the panel. I was wondering if they're saying that psychedelics can work to make you a better observer, whether you're born again or whatever that means, and then why or why not? Because I was just wondering how it actually works to help people, and I'll listen to the answer off air. Thanks.
And that can be both religion and science. I'll do the religion half of it first and go to Brian for the science.
Okay, yeah, I won't speak towards the kind of scientific mechanism, but I can say that for sure that psychedelics are unlike any other drug that is out there, any other sort of experience that's out there. And you will, when you consume these, if you take the so-called heroic dose, then you can
define a heroic dose
is enough to get you, I'll give you some more language here, is to get you past threshold. And when you're past threshold, then you are in the state of ineffability. And in this state of ineffability, en route to that state, and certainly within that state, you might confront or think about particular issues that are disturbing you, that you're working on, and you will have no choice but to think about them. And you will work through them and think about them in whatever way that your brain takes you. You might start seeing things that, that aren't there, let's say, mm-hmm. That you can't explain or can't understand, that fill you with awe or fill you with confusion or fill you with questioning things or fill you with an understanding of your connection with all things. And then once you emerge from this experience and you're in a state where you can talk again, people might ask you about what you saw, what things you were working through, And just like having therapy with a therapist, that these drugs will help facilitate those sorts of questions arising and those sorts of answers being given to you by either yourself, or if you're a religious person, you might think it came from elsewhere. But there's no question that I tend to describe the consumption of these drugs is a lot like a snow globe, and that once you consume the drug and it starts having an effect on you, then you are shaken. And in a snow globe, snowflakes are all over the place suddenly when it's shaken, and then they settle in a different orientation, and you are assured that the way that you think about yourself, the way that you think about your relationships, the way that you think about your relationship with the world, that it will be different after you consume these substances.
I love the analogy. Dr. Barnett, what happens to my brain when I take these substances?
Well, you know, from a psychological perspective, we do think that the subjective effects are very important here. There are already companies that are looking at lower doses of psychedelics to see if they might have antidepressant effects and that sort of thing. And I'm skeptical about how that's going to turn out. They might find, you know, something that helps people a little bit. But I really feel like the mystical experience is a primary driver of the effects here. And, you know, what's happening from a neuroscience perspective is, well, we're not certain about a lot of this. You know, the field's very young, but it looks like a couple things. So you have what's called the default mode network in your brain, which is active when you are self-reflecting and, you know, not really thinking about the outside world. And that tends to be overactive in people with psychiatric conditions. So people who are depressed, anxious, people with addictions. And it looks like psychedelics turn that network off and reboot it so that when it comes back on, it's not in such a rigid form. There's more cognitive flexibility. People are able to look at the world differently, you know, see things through a different perspective than they had previously. And then it also looks like there's an increase in what's called neuroplasticity after use. And so that's the cognitive flexibility that I'm talking about, but at a neuronal level. So neurons in the brain are able to make new connections that they had not previously been able to make. So in a way, it's sort of rejuvenating for the brain. And that's really probably what leads to a lot of the benefit here, particularly after use. People should really be engaging in some sort of therapeutic activity so that they can build a new worldview while they have this period of probably several weeks afterwards, maybe even several months, to take advantage of that neuroplasticity.
I know you're not dealing with depression right now, Dr. Barnett, but I had an email come in about a person receiving ketamine treatments for depression once a week. Says the treatments work, but at $400 a treatment or $20,000 a year, can't afford them for long. We've seen the skyrocketing cost of legal marijuana in Ohio. Do you think psychedelics might follow the same pattern if legalized, if used for therapy?
I think this is a really important question because we do have the data that are really building for efficacy. And so I think we will get to the point where we get FDA approval for these compounds. But then the next question is how do you pay for them? And this is a very logistically heavy treatment. So you have two therapists who are with the patients at all times. You know, psychedelics can vary in length of action from 6 to 12 hours. And so tying two therapists up for that long is more psychiatric treatment than most patients will get in a year if they're seeing a psychiatrist for a 30-minute visit every month. So it's going to be very expensive. Now, one issue that's going on with ketamine is that it's not technically FDA approved for treatment of depression. And therefore, there's no insurance coverage for it. And as a result, people are having to pay astronomical amounts out of pockets. Some people pay up to $2,000 in infusion. Now, with psychedelics, we don't anticipate things reaching that level because they would have to be FDA approved to even be used at all. And there are already efforts underway to obtain billing codes to be able to bill for psychedelic-assisted therapy in conjunction with the American Medical Association and CMS, which runs Medicare and Medicaid. And so there's quite a movement underway to work on getting these covered. However, we can probably expect for the first few years that they're out that insurance companies would be pretty resistant to coverage until it can be demonstrated that these are cost-effective.
Right.
We're going to take a short break here. Obviously, there's enough of you with a lot of interest. We're going to take this to the top of the hour, if that's okay with you.
Totally okay with
Perfectly.
Me.
Perfectly. Okay, 866-578-0903, the number to call. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. We'll be back in 60. You're back with The Sound of Ideas talking about trips. And since we're talking about drugs here, my guests are Dr. Brian Barnett, the psychiatrist and co-director of the Treatment-Resistant Depression Clinic at the Cleveland Clinic, Dr. Deepak Sarma, inaugural distinguished scholar in the public humanities at Case Western Reserve University, here in studio with me. A lot of phone calls, a lot of emails to get to, but I was kind of wondering, Brian, who's this study aimed to help?
So we're really looking at people who have anxiety. Anxiety, it's often in the shadow of depression in terms of our larger societal discussion, but anxiety can be very serious, very crippling. We do know that severe anxiety is a risk factor for suicide, and we do have data from 1950s, 1960s showing that LSD was helpful for anxiety then, particularly in patients who were dealing with cancer and other serious disorders who had associated anxiety. And so this is an extension of that work to patients who have generalized anxiety, but don't necessarily have a serious medical condition.
What would be the ideal outcome for this round of trials at the clinic?
So we do various psychological batteries to look at severity of psychiatric disorders and which disorders patients might have. And so we will be measuring the severity of the anxiety using a scale, which looks at a variety of aspects, how it's interrupting the patient's life, how it interrupts things like sleep, physical manifestations, such as palpitations, shortness of breath. Anxiety can manifest in so many ways. And so we will be looking at that routinely. And then a month after treatment, if that isn't improved to a considerable degree, then that would be considered a success.
I had a couple of requests to give the number again. They want to get in contact with you. Was it 216-828-5471? Is that it, Dr. Barnett?
That's correct.
That is correct. Okay. And again, we'll put that up on the website. Let's jump out to Bruce, who's been on the line for a while. Bruce, welcome to The Sound of Ideas. What's your thought?
Hey, thank you. So I'm really interested in this. I am both an addictions therapist and a rabbi. So I wanted to comment as a rabbi first that there is no tradition in any of the mainstream expressions of Judaism that embrace the use of intoxicants. We can argue about a little wine at celebrations, but certainly not intoxicant drugs. But my real question comes as an addictions therapist. With opioids and benzodiazepines, amphetamines, we've been chasing addiction for a long time. And there's no question that even under these controlled situations that psychedelics are abusable. And so the question is, what safeguards are being put in place now with the early study stages to help safeguard against abusability down the road?
Dr. Barnett, you handle the abuse part, and then we'll go over to Dr. Sarma for the religious part.
Yeah, this is an important question. I think it's essential to state that psychedelics do have risks, and that can range from bad trips to people who have bipolar or schizophrenia in their family, even becoming psychotic or manic. And then there is addictive potential. However, we do know that among psychoactive drugs, that psychedelics have the least potential. And that's probably for a variety of reasons. One is that the receptor that they primarily act through, the 5-HT2A receptor, it's actually taken up inside of cells after it's activated more than a couple times. So unlike most drugs, you can't really use psychedelics more than about 3 days in a row. And then you need to take a break for about a week or so before they will even work again. So that's very different from, opioids or cocaine, which you can use multiple times throughout the day, every day. So they do sort of have a built-in safeguard there. But with that said, we do see a rare number of people who do misuse psychedelics. And as part of the trials, we screen out anyone with active addiction. We do drug screening. And I think the setting that people are receiving these in is also going to be important for preventing addiction, because it is a therapeutic setting where they are with medical professionals. And I think that's very different than people who might be using these with other drugs, in party settings, that sort of thing. What we do find is that when people do misuse psychedelics, they are often addicted to multiple substances. It's very rare to have a psychedelic addiction alone. And so we know the people who are going to be vulnerable to this, and we are excluding those people from our trials.
Thank you.
Right. So this is just such a fascinating bunch of questions here. And it's hard for me not to consider the kind of creation of the allopathic category system. And when we think about something as being abused, then we really have a metric of how it should be used and how it shouldn't be used. And perhaps if it's FDA approved and if you use it against FDA approval, then according to that definition, it would be abused. Mm-hmm. But surely if we look at peyote use among the Native American communities and the Native American church, is it being abused by them? Is it being abused by people in Peru that are using ayahuasca and DMT? So when we think about abuse, we have to think about the creation of the category abused in the same way that we have to think about the creation of the category drug. So when we say that these are drugs, what are we doing when we call them drugs? We're placing them within kind of a medical imperialist paradigm.
It's a man-made construct.
It's a man-made construct. And it certainly began, let's not forget, Schedule I drug list. This is just a creation. In the first week of the class that I teach on drugs, religion, and mystical experience, we look at the term drug and how is it used and whether or not these are drugs. Are they drugs? Are they medicines? And when you call them medicines, then you're automatically assuming there's a therapeutic benefit. And when we say, I think the rabbi said intoxicant, when you call it an intoxicant, then you're applying another category on this, really a judgment category more than anything, like this is good, this is bad. You can use, as I like to say to my students, like you can go to the drugstore, but you can't go and meet your drug salesman, right? Like you can't, like, don't do drugs, but you might need these drugs.
Yeah.
You can do these drugs. So I think that we have to be aware of the hypocrisy and the creation of these categories by humans, and then suddenly they become reified and they become part of these structures that we imagine are built into the very nature of the way we think about the world, but they are human constructions.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's jump across the line to Western Pennsylvania. Thomas on the line. Welcome to the Sound of Ideas.
Yes. I wanted to mention a couple of things that I've read on this. One is about PTSD and experiences that people who've been treated have had one or two treatments and have not had to go back. And then I'd like to throw in Aldous Huxley, who took this on his deathbed. I forget what drug it was that he took, and had a marvelous experience. And I was wondering whether anything's being done about that with people who are with death and dying.
Dr. Barnett.
Yeah, I can take that. So there is certainly a lot of research underway right now looking at the use of psychedelics for people with serious medical conditions who may be nearing death, or the possibility is very likely. And then there's some very intriguing work going on in Boston right now at associated with Dana-Farber, where they're using psychedelics. They're using psilocybin to treat patients in palliative care settings. So hopefully to help them have a more positive transition. And so I really do think that psychedelics are going to upend the world of palliative care medicine.
You know, Brian, Deepak and I were talking about the illegality of these substances and what we categorize them as. What's the process like for getting approval to use them in your tests?
Well, it's a lot of paperwork. And yeah, I have to say that we've been working for more than a year to get this study going. And yeah, there are a lot of people involved. You have to, you know, this is an industry-sponsored study, so luckily we do have a lot of support from the company that's funding the research. But yeah, there's a lot of back and forth with the FDA. There have to be DEA-compliant storage facilities, and so it's certainly a team effort, and it's quite time-consuming. And you know, really, as a researcher, I would like to see that process changed so that we could speed up this work. And I think there are people, you know, lobbying Congress now trying to make that happen.
What will the process be like to make LSD approved as a medicine? You say it could go congressional, but is this something we can expect to see in years or decades?
Well, so LSD is going to be a little bit longer, but probably this time next year, MDMA will be approved by the FDA for treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. So that's the compound that's furthest out in research, and probably a couple of years after that, we're likely to see psilocybin approved for treatment of depression. And so LSD, this study is the first industry-sponsored study of LSD in about 50 years in the United States. So this is just the beginning, and then if the results are positive, there will be a couple more trials. And so I would say something on the order of 5-6 years, we would see LSD approved for medical use in the U.S. if studies continue to be positive.
Okay, I'm glad we had the extra time, but we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Dr. Brian Barnett, psychiatrist with the Cleveland Clinic. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Deepak Sarma is an inaugural distinguished scholar. They work in the public humanities at Case Western Reserve University. Thank you for coming in today.
Sure. Safe journeys.
Safe journeys. Thank you. To get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org or on Twitter @SoundOfIdeas. Tomorrow, we'll talk about a documentary at this year's Cleveland International Film Festival examining the impact the pandemic has had on the many Filipino Americans working in the healthcare industry. I'm Rick Jackson. Thanks for listening. We will talk to you tomorrow.
Truckin', got my chips cashed in, keep truckin'.